nanohub.org.
Online simulation and more for nanotechnology.
So today we'll continue the discussion about negative bias temperature instability. In last class we talked about DC degradation, that if you have a continuous DC voltage applied to a transistor, a MOSFET, then what would be the projected lifetime? What would be the power law that will dictate long time projection? Today we'll talk about what happens if you turn the transistor on and off as it happens in the circuit, whether you have additional time that you can gain. Obviously, you'll gain additional time because when it is off, at the worst, it will not generate anything new. And if we are lucky, it will probably recover or heal a few. And so, therefore, we can anticipate longer lifetime. And that is the goal of my lecture today, to look into frequency and duty cycle dependencies. So I have a set of topics to discuss. I'll talk a little bit about this connection between DC stress, the degradation in DC stress, and how many recover at the end of, during the time when no bias was applied. We'll talk about the frequency independence and the corresponding lifetime projection. Frequency independence means that whether you operate your circuit at 1 hertz, or whether you operate your circuit at 1 gigahertz, the degradation will be the same, provided you operate it for a same period of time, let's say 1 year. You operate your transistor 1 year at 1 hertz versus your friend operates it at 1 gigahertz, the total degradation will be the same. And this is unusual, and we'll see that why that happens. Duty cycle dependence essentially says that your transistor is not on all the time, and even when it's on, sometimes it's on for 25% of the total cycle, sometimes 75%. So depending, because all parts of the circuit are not operated at the same duty cycle. It's not on all the time. And we'll see how it depends on the duty cycle. Of course, if your duty cycle is zero, that means you're not operating your transistor at all, then you realize that there'll be no degradation. If it is 1, then it's DC degradation, which you have calculated in the last class. The question is, in between, how does it happen? And then I want to tell you something about the notion of a measurement. And measurement is this measurement, although it's a purely a semi-classical phenomena, you know, it's a classical phenomena about atoms moving, coming back, repassivating. But you will see that there is this magic of measurement, just like quantum mechanics. The more you measure, the less accurate you are. So there is sort of a trade-off between frequency of measurement and the accuracy of your result. That's very strange, because generally we think that if we interrogate more, we'll get better information. Here we'll see that in fact we'll not only get worse information, we can have wrong physics if we measure too much. So we have to ask fewer questions, and then I'll conclude. Now this is a review from the last lecture. And we are talking about DC, just to remind you. And the transistor on the top right has been rotated 90 degrees. The substrate is on the left. Polysilicon gate is on the right. And the silicon hydrogen bonds are getting dissociated. And then once the hydrogens are available, I told you that free hydrogen, it finds it difficult to move in a network. And therefore, the only way they can move easily is first dimerize and then as a H2 move around. That's easier to diffuse. And the experimental results are shown here on the bottom. Red, brown, and green curves essentially are three different voltages, degradation at three different voltages plotted in a log-log curve, a log-log plot. And you can see the slope. If you take the later part, let's say from 10 to the power minus 2 seconds, which is 10 milliseconds, to about a couple of hours, if you take a slope here, you'll see it's on the order of 1/6, a feature that we have discussed in the last class. And how we went about doing that? We essentially said, very briefly, just to remind you, that there is a reaction equation, which is the first equation on the top, which at relatively early phase can be simplified to the second equation, which is simply an algebraic equation connecting the number of defects generated at a particular time to the number of interface hydrogen at the boundary. And the second equation is a sort of a reformulation of the diffusion equation, that whatever number of defects you have, I'm sorry, the third equation from the top, whatever number of defects you have generated must be equal to whatever number hydrogen has been released, because initially they were together. So anytime you see a free hydrogen moving around, that must mean a broken bond somewhere else. So you just essentially equate them. And the fourth equation here says the reaction between two hydrogen producing an H2. This is the law of mass action. You can see NH squared because there are two hydrogen. If three hydrogen went together, then it will be NH cube. And we had this producing one H2, so on the denominator we have NH2. Three equations, three little equations, all algebraic, you put them together and we realize that the total defect generation goes as T⁻⁙, as you can see on the exponent, and this exponent is independent of voltage, temperature and any other feature. It's a robust universal exponent, this 1.46, which can be used as a indicator of what type of physics is going on. Had it been 1/4, we would have concluded that it is H diffusion, yet hydrogen is diffusing on its own. If it were half, we would have said this is proton diffusion. So, you know, these features you can calculate. All the voltage dependencies, all the temperature dependencies, hiding in the forward dissociation rate Kf, the Kr, all the processing dependencies, hiding is N0. Because if you have 1-1-1 surface versus 1-0-0 surface, you will have different number of dangling bonds and therefore your N0 will be hiding over there. Bottom line is that if you have a DC degradation to the zeroth order, we are just focusing on time today, not voltage and temperature. So we can take all the prefactors, put it as a, some constant A. We'll not worry about it. T⁻N, we are thinking about time today. Now, one thing about the robustness of this prediction is that if you take all the data that has ever been reported in the literature, various companies, various research labs, remember everybody in the semiconductor industry has to worry about it. If you take all the data, you will see all of them are at 1/6, this 0.15 or so, with a little variation. Everybody has the same time exponent. This is how robust the phenomena is. So you can take data for a couple of hours, project it to 10 years, you will be fine because you can rely on this prediction. Now the thing is, often this predicted lifetime, you can predict it, but then the result is not something you would like, because it would say that the safe operating voltage where you can operate it is actually pretty low. Your circuit cannot run at high speed at that voltage. So people then try to find some other things to see whether you can operate it for longer. And one thing is, you immediately say that, well, no computers operates in DC. They all operate at turn on and off. So perhaps when things are turning on and off, let's say in a ring oscillator on the middle panel, you see there you have a set of inverters, PMOS on the top, NMOS on the bottom. And if you have one in the input, the next one will be zero. The next one will be one, the far right one will be zero. There'll be a ring. And then once you toggle it to one in the input, all the other things will go to zero and one, depending on how the inversion would take place. And so therefore, a DC is never used in the circuit. Moreover, and so therefore, what experimentally people have seen is that on the bottom left plot, I am plotting time and IDSAT in a log-log plot. Once again, there is T⁻⁙ for this triangle, black triangle, lower triangle. And this is something we just discussed. But that thing, interesting thing is that first, when you do AC, your degradation is less. And you can immediately see, if you can project it for 10 years, in fact, you will project it a longer lifetime, safe operating lifetime, which therefore you can then use a little bit higher voltage. If your 10 years is your goal, then you can use it for a slightly higher voltage. Second is that it doesn't matter what frequency you have, all of them have the same degradation. So why is this? I mean, why does this thing occur? Because hopefully if that higher frequency, my degradation kept dropping, maybe I wouldn't have to worry about it at all. So why is it it's not going down with frequency as I might have expected? Moreover, finally, all circuits, all elements are not always operate at 50% duty cycle. A frequency means, a uniform frequency means 50%, right? 50% on, 50% off. That would be for the for any input circuit. But generally, what you find that the duty cycle, as you reduce the duty cycle for various elements, then what we'll find, again, if you plot in a log-log plot, number of defects generated, which is proportional to IDSAT, the number of defects generated as a function of time, lower the duty cycle, lower the degradation, of course. But the thing is, how much lower? You can see it's not really linear. Going from 75% to 25% doesn't give you just a factor of 3 or so difference, a log plot. So what is that dependency? Because in a circuit, if you have to predict what that circuit is going to do at the end of 10 years, then, of course, you need a precise statement about duty cycle dependence. Yes.
I can't understand why the frequency is, the degradation is independent of frequency.
That is the purpose of the lecture today.
Okay.
That is why I want to explain. That's what I wish to explain. Yes.
So, the peak voltages in all the frequencies, they are equal?
They are equal. So, the question is, if the peak voltage for all the frequencies, they are equal. You can think about it square pulses, and the height is the same, but the frequency is different, but the integrated time is the same in both cases.
Also, for when I'm changing the duty cycle, the peak is the same. So
duty cycle, peak is the same. We'll see how it comes about. Yes? Bottom right. This is not a measurement. It's just a simulation. I'll show you experiment. So the bottom right is a simulation. We'll show an experiment later on. So they have all sorts of circuit. Most of them are various types of ring oscillators. And then they have small logic circuits, and especially the ISCAS benchmark circuits. Various implementations of it, they will look into this. Okay, we'll go through the details. Let me go through the general flow. Don't ask too many questions, but we can always answer. If you are worried about anything specific on this slide, please do ask. I can answer, but yeah, go ahead.
It's actually about the circuit.
Sure.
So in most of the circuits, the gate voltage never becomes negative.
Yes, so the question is, how does NBTI occur, right? In the last lecture, I explained that the PMOS has the source and drain at VDD, and the input at zero. And so the input with respect to source and drain is negative. Therefore, the gate is negative with respect to source, and then that gives rise to NBTI.
Only for the PMOS.
Everything we are doing is only for the PMOS. PMOS is a, NBTI is a PMOS specific thing. All right. So now, sorry, what happened? Okay. Now we are going to solve these equations for this AC degradation. Now, of course, you can see this is a horrendous equation, and my simple approach that I did before is not going to work. It produced a power law, but as you can see, that this equation, when you're trying to solve it for AC degradation, would be much more complicated. So we'll try to do that in a simple way. You can put it in the computer, but there is no computer in the world that will do a million cycle of this and be able to simulate over a long period of time at 2 gigahertz, let's say. Because this would be too computationally intensive. You cannot prove the frequency independence by doing numerical simulation. Experiments show it, but you know, you never can trust experiments 100% because the experiments could be wrong at different frequencies. So we have to see whether there is a theoretical justification. So let me explain how this works. And the way I will explain it is, first we will think about what happens when you turn things on and off. So the way it works is the following. You see, I have four panels in here. So let's say for first 1,000 seconds is like 3 hours or so. 1/3 of an hour, let's say. For 1,000 seconds, you turn it on. So you can see that the number of defects are growing up. and then you turn it off, completely off, 0 volt, and then from 1000 to 2000 seconds, it is relaxing. The number of defects are coming down. Again, you put it up, put another voltage, same voltage as before, defects are growing, and then you allow it to relax, it's going down. So what's happening in terms of the hydrogen and other things from a numerical simulation, you can ask this question, that what happens during this time? So what happens during this time is, on the x-axis I have position into the oxide, and the y-axis I have number of hydrogen that are available, and the first, this dashed blue line, that is the number of hydrogen liberated within 2 seconds. So of course few of them are liberated, and this is the triangle that we discussed in the last class. This blue one going up and coming down with zero, that is the triangle. Now at 95 seconds or 450 seconds, more defects are generated, and gradually the diffusion front, the red and the black, are going as square root of dt. And so as the time is getting longer, more and more defects are getting generated. So this is what will happen if you kept the DC forever. Gradually, the number of defects would have gone up. Now what happens when you turn it off? When you turn it off, of course, in that case, no new defects are getting generated. However, there are hydrogen floating around. They can come back and passivate. And once they passivate, then let's say at 1,002 seconds, in the blue curve in the middle second panel, you can see a few of them has gone back and passivated the surface. And so you have a little bit fewer. On the red, the second one, which is a little bit later, you can see few more on the left of the peak has gone back and passivated the surface. But equally important, look at the tail on the right-hand side for the red. Now, those hydrogen, they do not know that the defect generation has stopped. And so they will keep going to the right because they are doing random hopping. So they do not know. And so therefore, this will keep going. And if you look at the right, the red, black, then that's like 1450 seconds. And at 1450 seconds, you can see that a larger fraction on the left of the peak, they have gone back and passivated the silicon hydrogen bond, and the things have further proceeded on the right through diffusion. So the part on the left of the peak is called a diffusion hole, because things have gone back by diffusion and therefore leaving behind a hole. Now, if you again allow a defect generation to continue, what will happen? What will happen, this hole will quickly fill up, and you can see in 2002 seconds, you have that blue curve, and that blue curve, essentially, the very early part of the blue curve, when it's coming down, in that case, these are new hydrogen that are getting generated, gradually filling up the hole. And then the red fills up the hole a little bit more, diffusion hole a little bit more, and then after a while, it will forget that there was ever a hole there, because new defects will essentially fill it up. And finally, of course, if you turn it down, this process will go on. There'll be passivation back. So you can see this strange thing. So there's a defect generation. When you turn it off, passivation. But passivation, a fraction of them, and the remaining part keeps going. And then again you start further defect generation. So there's this push-pull about number of hydrogen that are getting generated, and that is getting reflected in the NIT, the number of NIT. And you see one thing immediately, that the number of defects at the end of 2000 seconds did not come back to zero. For hole trapping, you trapped, and then when you allowed sufficient time, it detrapped. And so therefore, the value went to zero. So you could start from zero again. Here, on the other hand, you can see that while at the end of 2000 seconds, that there are still a significant high amount of hydrogen which are available, which is sort of seen in the second panel on the bottom. There is whatever number of hydrogen is available at the end of 2000 seconds, that says how many defects are still unpassivated. So how do you solve this problem? Now it turns out that until probably 50 years ago, nobody could solve this problem. These are nonlinear differential equations. And the technique started evolving about 100 years ago. But these type of equations are extremely important. And I will tape a few slides as an appendix later on. But these type of equations are nonlinear equations. And how do you solve nonlinear equations like this? There are many techniques. You know how to solve general differential equations, right? How do you do it? Series method, Fourier series, you can do Laplace transform, various types of series solutions you have. Nonlinear equations, the trick I'm going to tell you, applies generally to power law, the solutions that are generally power law. So where do you have to start? You have to start from something called a self-affine transform. This is how it works. Think about three boxes. A blue box, a green box, and I do not know what color this is, the biggest box. Now, if you look at it, these three boxes are obviously different, but if you put them on top of each other and then scale by two factors, one factor for the X and another factor for the Y, you can make all the boxes look the same. If you have one scale factor, that's called self-similar. If you have two scale factors, that's called self-affine, so that you can put these pieces together. I'll explain immediately why it comes in the solution. So this is the NBTI degradation. In the first cycle, goes up, comes down. Second cycle, goes up, comes down, starting from a particular point, and you go on to the kth cycle. K could be 10 billion. The question is, at the end of 10 billion, as I told you, no computer in the world ever would be able to calculate this. So only way is analytically, you have to prove, mathematically you have to prove what the result at the end of 10 billion cycle is going to be. And the thing is, this trick allows you to do that. So I'm showing you how to do this. So the first thing is, what is the self-affinity in here? So what you do, take the first cycle, copy it down. So in the slide below, in the figure below, the first blue on the bottom, that's the copy of the first cycle from the top. Take the second cycle, shift the origin to zero, as I have done it here in the second one, and subtract the Y zero point. So that would be the first point on the second cycle, subtract it so that the origin goes to zero. You continue doing this for whatever number of cycles you are interested in. It could be 10, 100, 1000, whatever. And you will get a series of this thing. So you have repeatedly folded back the solutions. Then you do a Y scaling. Y scaling means keep the first one 1, first cycle, top of the first cycle 1, and scale by a factor, whatever factor is necessary. And the remarkable thing is, this is essentially similar. They are all essentially, apart from a little factor here, in the beginning, maybe in the middle of the stress cycle and towards the end of this relaxed cycle, essentially similar. Even if you did 100 billion of them, they will be very close to similar. And this property, what it allows us to do is that we will look at the first scale, first stress and relaxation, and then we'll have a series of recurrent relationships, and then that will solve the entire equation. So I want to show you slowly, and you will have the opportunity to look at it when you go home and look at the lecture, because these things, of course, requires a little bit of thought. But let me try to explain as clearly as I can. So let's start with the first cycle. See whether I can have an analytical theory of the first cycle. And you remember that during the first cycle, on the left is a stress front. Essentially, you allow a certain time, let's say 1,000 seconds. So your tau naught will be 1,000 seconds, and you have produced a certain amount of hydrogen. Then you are allowing it to relax. Now I have shown on the right an approximation of the relaxation process. Relaxation looks complicated. The white region are the number of hydrogen which has come back and passivated the surface. The green one, the green triangle that you see, are still the remaining hydrogen which are still there. We are thinking about the relaxation cycle. The stress cycle, we did it in the last class. The relaxation cycle is what we're going to do today. Now, in star H, essentially, is the peak of that triangle. So let's see how many, let's calculate the area of the white, the number that has been passivated back. Because at the end, my goal is to calculate the area of the green, because that is how many are remaining. And that will be the number of defects that are at any point for the relaxation. So how do you do this? So generally, of course, this will keep going down. And this is the approximation. On the left, I showed the animation for how things are going down. On the right is an approximation, linear approximation of the profile in the left. Now, how many, if you wanted to calculate the area of the white triangle, how would you calculate it? Let's see whether we can calculate it. Do you see the height is going to be NH star X? That is the height. And the height of the green triangle or the corresponding for the white one, and you have to multiply with what? The lateral shift in the x-axis, lateral shift, and that will be 2 xi square root of 2 xi dht. That is how many could have diffused back. But we are just looking at one-sided diffusion. It is just diffusing back towards the interface. So to account for that, we have a xi. Xi is on the order of half. So let's not worry about the xi for the time being. The point is that that's the area of the white triangle. Now, what is the area of this green triangle? Let's see how much it is. Remember that I have already stressed up to time t naught, and I'm allowing further time t, extra time t. So the base will now shift to square root of dt. But the t is now t plus t naught. That is how far it has diffused out. Half is because this is a triangle, and NH star x gives you the height. And so that's the green. Now remember, the fraction, the white plus the green, must be equal to whatever I generated at the end of the last cycle. Because the fraction has gone passivated and the fraction still remains. And so therefore, you must have this relationship that NIT T plus TH, TH is the amount of time you stressed, plus the N star T plus TH, that is the fraction that got passivated, must be equal to whatever you generated at the end of the previous cycle, right? Because either it has to passivate or it has to stay, whatever you generated. And so you can solve these equations, and in one line I will show you, in a few lines I will show you how to do that. So you have those two equations that we have just calculated. You have these conservation relationship, that the number of hydrogen which has come back and passivated the surface, number of hydrogen which are still available must be equal to the number of hydrogen that were available at the end of the previous cycle. You put these two things in. I'm sorry, there should be a comma here. Just if you put these two things in, you can calculate analytically at any point how many defects you have available, what is the area of the green curve in terms of how many you produced at the end of the previous cycle. Right? So this is simply an equation. There is nothing much to it. These three lines of algebra, you can go in and take a look. And the important thing is you can see that only thing that matters is T over TH. In the final equation on the right, that how long as a fraction time, whatever time you stressed and how long you allowed it to relax, that is the only thing that matters. Everything else has gone away. And you can compare it with your numerical simulation just to see whether it's good or bad. You can put it in a linear plot. X-axis is time. Y-axis is threshold voltage shift. This numerical model or analytical model that I just told you about will be that. The numerical one is a solid line. And, you know, many times, of course, it's, you can hide important details in a linear plot. Then in a log plot, if the results are correct, should be good also. And you can see that same expression essentially works out. Now, the bottom line is that don't have to worry about the exact form. You can immediately, so long you know the definition. Xi is on the order of half because it's one-sided diffusion. TH is how long you stressed it. T is how long you allowed it to relax. And you put it in, and those three equations, you can predict how the curve is going to relax. On the top left, in the green, in the small plot, I'm showing you where we are. What are we plotting? We are plotting the relaxation phase. The stress phase, we did it in the last class. All right. So, remember, I have just done one cycle. I have to do a billion cycles. So, there will be few classes of doing this. It will be done soon. So, you start with this, this trick. At the end of the first cycle, I just showed you, calculated the number of defects at the end of first cycle. T is the total period of a cycle. And R2 is the ratio that I showed in the last slide. For example, R2 is 1 over this quantity. That is, by definition, I'm calling it R2. And so what this says, whatever number you generated at the end of the previous time, ATHN, because you stressed it in DC for time TH, this is your relaxation factor. That tells you at the end of the cycle how long, how much traps you have left. Remember, it looked like that given by the blue triangle because the white part went back and passivated it. Now, of course, if you want to keep doing this, it will be difficult. So what you people do in this type of analytical solution, use the concept of equivalent time. And this is what it means. Instead of keeping track of how many cycles you have done previously, what you do this notion of equivalent time, that how long of a DC time should you have to stress so that you have the same amount of residual defects at the end of a certain cycle. That is called an equivalent time. So what you do, you take this blue and make it a triangle. And the corresponding time, you say 2 DHT. So you already know how many defects you have. You calculated it. You equate it with this quantity. And once you equate it with this quantity, then by definition, the T sub E is the equivalent time. So this is sort of equivalent how long you have to stress so that you don't have to keep track of your previous history, right? So that this is sort of the total integrated DC effect up to that point. And of course, that gives you a relationship between TE and TH and as a function of R2 is a relaxation and 1 over n. n is 1 over 6. So this 1 over n will be 6. Now, of course, if you want to continue stressing, all you have to do is to add, instead of thinking about T plus H, which is on the right in the green curve, instead of thinking about all this history, all you have to do is to keep track of TE. T plus T is equivalent to all this history. Now, for the first curve, it doesn't matter. But think about 591 cycles. In that case, the TE will contain the history of everything that has happened before, collapsed into one point. That's why the self-affine transform comes in, which allows you to collapse it to the first point. And then correspondingly, you can write whatever that at the end of the, first cycle and a half, whatever you want to calculate, that will simply be, using this relationship, will be TH plus TE to the power N, as if it was in DC degradation all the time. This thing as if it didn't happen. And all the history that it went up and came down, TE knows about that all. Right? So I'm trying to solve these nonlinear equations to get the frequency independent. That's where I'm going. And these are the steps of equation, solution of an equation, right? That's the goal. Now, these steps may look unfamiliar to you, but once you have mastered it, sort of any nonlinear differential equation that produces power law, you'll be able to solve it. Alright, so how does it work then? So I have this first cycle, second cycle, third cycle, and the kth cycle. And the duty cycle, D is TH divided by T. TH is how long it was on, divided by T is the total time. This is the solution, let's say. It goes up and down, depending on the first, second, and the kth cycle. At the end of the first cycle, NITTH, I know. Because this is just DC. Last class, I know how to do it. At the end of the relaxation period, I know. Because I just showed you at the end of relaxation, what should the value be. So I know that. Now, at any time like this, so every time I have a peak, I can use this recursive relationship to calculate the degradation at any cycle. 500, 5 million, 5 billion, at any cycle, I can just keep doing this recursion relationship. So by the way, the notes will all be posted, all the details tapes, so you can always take a look, just try to see the basic features, then it will be okay. And R of T will be the, by definition, will be the total degradation at a given time T, given by the red point, to whatever was the degradation at the end of the first trace period, NITTH, by definition. So there's nothing funny here, just a definition. So, what will be the value of R at the end of the first stress period? Well, by definition, it is going to be 1. Because I'm going to divide with NITTH, but I'm also looking at NITTH. So, R1 by definition would be equal to 1. What would be R2? R2 will be, by definition, NITTH plus TL. TH plus TL is the total period. So I'm going to, by definition, remember, so it's NITTH plus TL divided by, normalized to, the end of the first stress period. I already have shown you this, xi TL divided by T. That was the, when I did the relaxation, that was the value. Now, TL divided by T, I can always write it in terms of the duty cycle, because duty cycle is, by definition, TH divided by T. So you can just subtract it. And that's definition on the other hand. So R2 can be expressed in terms of R1. R1 is 1, so I just multiplied it. The remarkable thing is that when you look at R3, based on this notion of equivalent time, because you can see that T plus TH, which is the end of the end of the green region, you see, end of the stress period in the second cycle, I can write it in terms of the equivalent time, TE, as if it was stressed for during the whole time. The history of going up and down has been accounted for through the TE. I normalize it, and then I can show that this is equal to 1 plus R2, 1 over n to the power n. So this is one step, you have to do it at home. Or you can pause this slide, and then you can check it out. Algebra, nothing, no rocket science. If you keep doing this, very soon you will find that R2k minus 1 is equal to 1 plus R2k minus 2. That means every odd cycle, end of the odd cycle, is 1 plus whatever is the value, ratio of the value at the even node. 2k minus 2, always even, right? It's 2k minus 2, and 2k minus 1, always odd. So, odd part has been connected to the even part, regardless the value of k. So, you can have 1 million 2 connected to 1 million 3. So, this is the odd part. And it turns out that you can also do the even odd part. That's in the notes. That for 2k, meaning the end of the 2k k cycle, this 2k, is a combination of whatever happened in the previous part and whatever happened one step back. So if you know this three steps, then you can connect it up. So now this is the recursion relationship. So I have the original R2 that I derived, and I have this recursion relationship. I'm done. because I can solve now any equation with this, right? So this is the trick, because you see every equation has a way of, you have to ask it properly and nicely, then it will tell you the answer. And so this is how you solve this problem. All right, so let me show you how it works. So I told you that, and I told you about this odd events, even odd cycles. And I'm going to show you in the next slide, but let me tell you the answer first so that you can see. What I'm going to show you in the next slide is that once you put this thing in, you can make it a series out of the odd cycles alone. So you can start with 3003, connect it to 3001, and then recurse it on the odd cycle only. If you just solve those two equations, you can sort of see that there may be a way to solve it, but it requires a special trick. And this part, do you remember this part? This was the relaxation at the end of the first cycle. So this is the, remember the xi 1 minus d, this is where the relaxation of the first cycle. And if you iterate, at the end of the day, your answer is going to be, whatever is your cycle number, minus 1, xi you know, 1 minus d you know, it is going to be, the answer is simply going to be linear in k. Think about it now for 1 second. Let's say you want to predict the degradation at the end of 1000 cycle. All you have to do, put k equals 1000, xi you know, duty cycle you know that the end of 1000 cycle, what is the degradation? If you want to put it at 1 billion, all you have to do is to put k is equal to 1 billion and you are done. So this is the strange part, that although the curve is so complicated in a log plot going up and down, at the end of the day, it turns out it is linearly proportional to the number of cycles, of course, multiplied by a proper relaxation factor. This is why the AC curve is a little bit down than the DC curve. Okay. So we'll see how it works out. So let me show you very quickly the mathematical step, because it takes a little bit of trick. Even if you look at the notes, you may not be able to follow this if this is not done properly. All right. So you take these two relationships. Now the trick is this. You take the relationship in the red and insert the relationship on the right in the black in the second line. But the trick is that you will immediately see that that requires writing the black in terms of R2k minus 2, because the red, the second term on the right, that requires it right in terms of 2k minus 2. But instead of writing the second 2k minus 2 in terms of the black, then you rewrite it in terms of the red. Right? So you just have to put this first relationship in the black equation and put the whole thing back into the first equation. So this is just one step. You have to just take a look. And if you do the algebra, you can do the recursion. If you do the algebra, you will get the series relationship that only connects the odd states. 2k minus 1 is connected to 2k minus 3. And 2k minus 3, therefore, can be connected to 2k minus 5, and so on and so forth. So now you can see where the frequency independence comes from. So the degradation at the end of kth cycle, if I have frequency, duty cycle is half, let's say, up and down, constant frequency, so d is half. The whole thing is a constant. So I can say that the whole thing is 2/3 k. The point is it's equal to k. Now, if you wanted to look at what happens at frequency f1 and what happens at frequency f2, then what we'll do in case of, remember, the total time is the same. So k1 t1 for low frequency must be equal to k2 t2 for the high frequency. They have to be the same because I'm looking at the end of 1 year, operated at two different frequencies. But you can immediately see, therefore, nit you can essentially have RK1, that is how the ratio of the first degradation multiplied by the ratio, and RK2. And then you can see that the ratio is given by K directly. So therefore, K to the power N gives you the ratio, K1, K2, and T1, T2 gives you the ratio for the first degradation. And once you put these two things in, you will see K1, T1 and K2, T2 are the same, because it's total amount of time. So the ratio is 1. Do you see this? And so therefore, regardless of what happens, what frequency you have, because K1, T1 and K2, T2 are the same integrated time, it does not matter what frequency you use. It will be independent of frequency. Right? It doesn't matter what the model parameter is, what type of MOSFET you used. Doesn't matter. You see, this pure math and saying you, the degradation is out.
What's the value of R1?
Where is the R1?
R1. R1 should be 1, right?
R1 is 1.
But if you use that formula, it gives you 0.
R1 is, gives you 0. Why would it give it 0? In here?
Minus 1. K is 1, right?
No, no, remember, if you want to do R1, then you should put, this is for infinite system. I'll take with, it should work for small systems also. But remember that I am making a set of assumptions when the system is very, number of K is very large. When I'm making these assumptions, assuming that K is very big. If the K is not very big, K is 1 or 2, then of course, so there is a correction, but you know, the correction is linear, maybe very small corrections. But I will take a look and then see what the value is. But the thing is that when you do hundreds and trillions of cycles over a period of month operating at a gigahertz, then the value would probably be essentially independent. 1 approximately. All right. Yes.
Last slide, like we said that it is frequency independent, but if we consider DC as f is equal to 0, then like there is difference between f is equal to 10 hertz and f is equal to 0 hertz.
But if it is DC, then you cannot use the AC formula, right?
Yeah, but like if we use it in limit f tending to 0, then...
But f tending to 0, you don't have any relaxation. So in that case, your duty cycle is close to 1. You can see that if the duty cycle is close to 1, this will become 0. So in that, I'm not sure one can use it in that limit. You have to have at least 1 hertz or a millihertz or a microhertz, but you cannot probably put it to 0, right? So physically, I did a lot of math. Of course, I don't like math very much. You have to do it because here you cannot put it on the computers and solve this problem. And physically, you can see what's happening. If you have a high frequency, 1 cycle, the hydrogen is pushed a certain amount and pulled back a little bit. On the other hand, if you have a... So this is the hydrogen profile, and it diffuses a certain amount into the oxide. If you have low frequency, well, you push a long period of time, and then you also allow a long period of time for it to relax. And so obviously, in that case, in that case, what will happen, that it will push, go a little bit farther. At low frequency, it will go. Obviously, these two cannot be the same. These two cannot be the same. What I'm saying, however, is not this, but rather this, which is, you can have high frequency, but the total time has to be the same. And you can have low frequency, no problem, but the total time has to be the same. Total integrated time. If you do that, then you can see that although for 1 cycle it is very different, if you have just 1 cycle, it's definitely not frequency independent in that sense. But if you have 200 cycles, this is a numerical simulation. If you have 200 cycles or 400 cycles, they will be exactly on top of each other, regardless of what the value is, what the frequency is. So here the frequency is double. And in one case, 100 and 200 cycles have the same thing. 200 or 400 cycles, 200 of the small, 400 of the fast, they have the same thing. I will let me cover this duty cycle dependence. The measurement I will discuss in the next class.
It's only when you have many cycles, right?
Many cycles, yes, yes.
If you have like 10 cycles, 5 cycles.
Yes, of course. You know, this is a recursion relationship. These solutions are not never exact. But the more cycles you have, the more accurate it becomes. Right? Because, of course, few cycles you can compute it in numerically, but you can see even for a few cycles, it's just 100 cycles. And look, in a log plot, going from 10 to the power 16 to 10 to the power 4, even in the tail, they are essentially indistinguishable. Even for 100 cycles. So if you go a million cycles, you can see they'll be even more precise. All right, so where the duty cycle dependence comes in? Very quick. Previously, people have said that the duty cycle dependence should go as D two-thirds. That's how 100% duty cycle, D is 1. D is 0, so no degradation. But in general, D to the two-third, you can see that this theory will immediately tell you what the duty cycle dependence has to be. Remember that relationship? That we have this P being that the extra factor, which for 50% duty cycle, I just put D equals 0.5. And then I didn't consider it any further. But of course, in here, the frequency could be the same, but the duty cycle is different. So again, what you can do is you can take the ratio of the AC and DC. And for the AC, you have to find the ratio for 2K minus 1 and NITTH. That's the first cycle. First cycle degradation in the first cycle. And you compare with the DC. DC has, if you continued for all K cycles, if it were completely DC, you never allowed it to relax, then it will have KT cycles for the DC. And if you put those two relationships back, you will get an expression for the duty cycle dependence, which is shown on the right. D divided by 1 plus square root of 1 minus D divided by 2 raised to the power n. And that duty cycle dependence is an exact expression for high number of cycles. And that is shown in the bottom right side, that the AC and DC ratio and as a function of duty cycle, you can see on the very right, when the duty cycle is 1, of course, the AC-DC ratio is 1. Do you see on the top? You can put the value of D is equal to 1. Do you see that becomes 1? On the other hand, when you put D equals 0, do you see that that expression reduces to 0 also? And anywhere in between, for any duty cycle, that expression will essentially coincide with the numerical simulation that you can do, and the result you can get after several days of simulation, you can get this left-hand curve, because this has many, many cycles going up and down at various duty cycles, so you have to resolve them properly. The analytical one, essentially this nonlinear curve, given by the set of, you know, circles, those correspond to the corresponding duty cycle. So, for example, for 5%, the green circle will give you the 5% point. The blue circle will give you the 25% point, and so on and so forth. And they will match exactly with numerical simulation. So therefore, bottom line is, given this duty cycle dependence and frequency independence, you can therefore project at any frequency and any duty cycle and use it for circuit simulation. You know, you often do spice modeling, right? MOSFET is very complicated. At the end, you cannot use those things in the circuit simulation. What do? You capture the essential physics in a little model that tells you various parameters, how to change things and all. This is sort of the SPICE model for NBTI degradation that accounts for the frequency dependence and as well as the duty cycle dependence of this. Now that you have seen how the frequency and duty cycle dependence play together and how it affects the NBTI degradation, now you will see something which combines both of them and interprets how measurements can affect NBTI degradation in the following way. It's very interesting and has almost an analogy with quantum mechanics. The more you measure, the less accurate it becomes. You see, on the left-hand panel, what I have done is plotted the delta Vt as a function of time for a set of different voltage or different temperatures. For example, 25, 90, and the green one is 150 degrees. And of course, the green one is at the maximum, you can see, and as it should be, because the temperature is high. But one thing, if you compare with the panel on the right-hand side, which I have been showing you repeatedly throughout this lecture, was that there's an important difference. If you look at the left-hand panel, the slope of the power law is t to the power 1/4. Does it mean that then for the left-hand panel, it's a hydrogen diffusion, and on the right-hand side, it is H2 diffusion, because this has a 1/6 exponent. As you have seen, 1/6 is a signature of hydrogen H2 diffusion. What is it? Can, maybe in the old days, it used to be hydrogen diffusion, H pure H proton or H diffusion. Today, it's H2 diffusion. Not really. This was a great dilemma for last 40 years. And I want to explain to you how essentially both are consistent and can be interpreted together in the following way. You see, in old days, when we used to think about measurement, we used to think about this in the following way. Let's say I have a transistor under a DC bias and NBTI degradation, and I'm periodically interrupting it at 1 second, at 10 seconds, at 100 seconds, at 1,000 seconds, gradually interrupting it. And then within this time, I am essentially stressing the device. And the idea is that the measurement is so short, so quick, that it does no harm. It doesn't change the result. Now, why do we want to do this in a log time scale? Like, why not 1, 2, 3, 4 seconds rather than 1, 10, 100 seconds? It's because, remember that this is a power law, so therefore, my scale has to correspondingly increase. So going from 1 to 10, 10 to 100 allows me to cover a longer distance within a fewer measurements. And the ratio in this case is 10. Ratio of the measurement point is about 10. 1 to 10, 100 to 10, 10 to 100, etc. This is what we used to think, that measurement does no harm. But in reality, what measurement actually does is that shown here in the bottom set of pulses. The yellow region is when we reduce the stress voltage or eliminated the stress voltage to temporarily do the measurement. Within this time, we might have thought that actually it does no harm. The yellow region does no harm. But as you have seen, let's say it takes 5 seconds. So that means that you stressed the gray curve, gray region for 1 second. And the yellow region is effectively 5 seconds. So therefore, you allowed 5 seconds of relaxation. Now, next time around, of course, you stressed it for 9 seconds, 10 minus 1. But then you allowed it to relax for 5 additional seconds. So what is happening in the beginning, what you are seeing, that you are allowing it to relax for a large fraction of the stress, 5 times more than the stress time. But as you are going higher and higher, the fraction of time you are using for relaxation during the measurement becomes a smaller and smaller fraction of the total time. And so one can view this measurement process itself as if it is a variable frequency AC stress. That although we thought that we continuously use DC, but simply because we stopped to make measurements, that means that essentially allowing us to relax. Now one can immediately show, and I will use it as a homework for you, that the variable duty cycle in the presence of this logarithmic stress time is something like this. The dN, the duty cycle, becomes 1 minus n is the number of cycles we are thinking about. T naught is a measurement time, 5 seconds here. R is the ratio, the interval ratio, and you can see over there 10. And TH is the first stress time, how long you stress for the first, when you made the first measurement. For example, here TH will be equal to 1 second. So let's see what does this variable frequency has to say about relaxation. You see, what the variable frequency says, that in the beginning, the D is very large. In the beginning, D is very large because in the beginning, you have N is equal to 1. And if N is equal to 1, you can immediately see that the duty cycle will be actually very, very large. In that case, then you will have a huge relaxation. The ACDC relaxation will be significant. On the other hand, as you are going farther and farther down in the measurement time in relationship to the stress time becomes smaller and smaller, and eventually it will be close to 1. Because you are interrupting only infrequently, over 10,000 seconds, you are taking off 5 seconds, so it will essentially be 1. So what it means that in the early stage of the measurement, you make a lot of error because you have the relaxation, you are allowing the relaxation to, its duty cycle is close to zero, relaxation is very significant. But at farther out, you make fewer and fewer errors because D is really almost like the DC measurement. And so this is what happens. If you could do an ideal measurement with, as if, with no relaxation, let's say you come down very quickly, measure in a nanosecond and go back, then you'd have that black dashed curve. That's the curve we really need for long time projection. But if you do a real curve where you are repeatedly measuring, interrupting and trying to do this, you will get this black, red oscillating things up and down. Every time you try to do the measurement, it relaxes. You put the stress again, it goes back, measure again, second relaxation, and so on and so forth. And in the log curve, you can see the role of relaxation gradually disappears. And so in the old days, what used to happen was that people used to measure at the end of the measurement cycle. So that was the envelope, the bottom envelope of the rate point, the rate curve is what they used to measure. And if you do this, if you make a sort of a measurement or simulation of this, you will see, although without delay or without the measurement, you have t to the power 1/6. In the old days, they used to make delay contaminated or measurement contaminated measurement. Measurement itself used to harm what you're trying to measure. And therefore, this used to be t to the power 1/4. This is the difference. So the measurement itself, more you measure, more relaxation you have, and more farther away it becomes from the true curve itself. Very much similar to a quantum mechanical problem where you try to interrogate too frequently, you will be less accurate in terms of the quantity you are trying to measure. So, in fact then, everything is actually H2 diffusion. The exponent with a fast measurement, or delay uncontaminated measurement, will give you 1/6. N.25 is only an apparent exponent that reflects the inability to measure fast. And that is to be the classical problem. So this explains why in old days, on the left panel, people would see the bottom envelope of those delay contaminated measurements and the exponent will be close to 1/4. And as you can see towards the end even of this curve, that gradually the curves are saturating. Although I have fitted it with straight lines, you can see in all three curves, the curves are gradually bending over. And if you measure it for long enough time, gradually these will all become t to the power 1/6 because the measurement interval will be essentially negligible. So to conclude then, I have explained how NBTI can heal itself when you let it relax or take the stress away for a certain period of time. And this is very important in terms of getting a longer lifetime for NBTI degradation. And we have been able to explain it by using a very simple theory of based on reaction diffusion model. I explained why NBTI is frequency independent. The good thing is that therefore you can make the prediction at high frequency, but the bad thing is that it's not going to disappear even when you are doing things at 2 gigahertz. So therefore we always have to account for it. Now the duty cycle dependence, of course, allows us more time. So for example, if the AC-DC ratio is factor of 2, that means that you have 64 times more, it will last 64 times more with AC analysis than in the DC. So that means that you can just test it for 2 months and it will be good for 10 years. And relaxation and the hole trapping, as I'll show, as I have shown, essentially complicate these measurements in non-trivial ways, as I just showed, that it became T to the power 1/4 and gave an appearance of that is hydrogen diffusion. Whereas, if you did an uninterrupted or uncorrupted measurement, that would have given you a very different power law, a power exponent, and very different interpretation of the physics. Therefore, one has to be very careful in doing the measurements and interpreting the corresponding NBTI results. So let me end here, and we'll discuss the voltage and temperature dependence in the next class.